This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College and the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative. This episode focuses on a novel and inspiring initiative in coastal Maine to look at ways that Rockland and neighboring communities can build collaborative networks to address problems with troubled youth for whom standard forms of intervention have not been working. Today, I have the enormous privilege to talk with two members of the steering group for the initiative, Rockland Chief of Police Tim Carroll and local resident Mark Munger, who's experienced in helping communities discover how to use more local and effective problem-solving strategies to deal with serious and chronic problems. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Chief Carroll, Mr. Munger, congratulations on this amazing grant. This is a significant chunk of change from the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is also known for our listeners as OJJDP, alongside other major grants to develop community-based solutions for intervening with young people who have been causing trouble. So, Chief Carroll, I'd like to come to you first and ask you to explain to our listeners the context in Rockland that led you and others to decide to apply for this grant. What was happening that made this grant kind of a significant choice for you to put your time and intervention into?
Of course, thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation. It started, I became the police chief here 2 years ago, almost to the day 2 years ago. And coming into it, just kind of, I'm from the area, so I'm aware of what goes on here, but I knew that there were specifically at Rockland, the Rockland Police Department, members were having trouble dealing with juveniles, acting out, just really in vulgar ways of yelling, screaming, and all-out fighting whenever a Rockland officer approached to whatever the disturbance was that they were creating. It was, you know, just running up and down the street, yelling vulgarities, or just as people were sitting on their own porch, yelling and screaming at them, and then causing damage as well. The public playground area, the picnic tables and stuff, they would carve things, they would just create little fires or something on there. And it was just, but when law enforcement was called, it was literally a fight. As we got out of the cars, they would come running at us, fighting, screaming, to the point of even, you know, I hope you commit suicide. Those are the types of actions that they were calling for the officers of Rockland. And it was just an all-out fight trying to get control of these kids. And then it really came to light, dealing with this a number of times, that there was no, once we detained them, because that's what we had to do, because they were physically fighting us or the problems they were causing, our hands got tied from there. And I understand, with Long Creek, the message from Long Creek of trying to close that down, I get that. And I'm not in any way, shape or form or fashion of, you know, wanting to arrest kids and detain kids. But we needed help. We need to do something. So we called on state agencies. We called, you know, probation, parole. We have to go through our juvenile corrections case officer. And at the end of the day, even though we had a fight, physical altercation, it was a battle getting them into the police station to have this conversation with them. They were given a piece of paper and released back out on the street to, again, that we would have to be called for 20 minutes, a half an hour later for the same actions. There was no resources that we could obtain to try to get these kids help. And I truly believe, and, you know, I've got that throughout the police department, that these kids are screaming for help. You know, most of the ones that we were dealing with were under some sort of foster care in state custody. And we would, you know, it started pushing back onto the state and we still got no answers. It was the same thing over and over. Some of these kids, there was some mental health crises that these kids were in, and we still had no recourse of action that we could do. Take them to the hospital. It wasn't a medical emergency, so they would be released. We would contact the JCCO. It didn't reach to the level of incarceration like Long Creek. These kids needed to, you know, a place to go for them to feel safe and feel compassion from others, I think. And it just wasn't there. We just kept throwing them back on the street. So what do we do? And some of my efforts was, it was protecting my officers. You know, the optics of a 6'5", I've got a 6'5", 230-pound police officer taking down a 13-year-old girl on Main Street. It doesn't look good. You know, it doesn't look good for the officer. It doesn't look good for Rockland Police Department. But that's literally what, those are our options at the time to try to get some sort of control. And we just didn't have any resources. There's no There's no real help out there. Shutting down Long Creek, but then the state didn't provide any other answers. So what do we do with these kids? Because we can't just keep returning them to the streets. I have a 13-year-old girl. It was known she slept with her 13-year-old boyfriend every night, and she's in state's custody. She went to, she did her weekly check-in to get birth control, but that was for the reason. And other than that, she was fighting with us on a daily basis. What do we do? What can we do? We've got to do something better. This is the answer to these kids is what we have is terrible. We've got to do something better. So that was kind of put out there. I put it out on the message out on Facebook. And then it's people like Mark. It's people like Jessica Berry saying, what can we do? We've got to do something better. Let's take care of our kids that we have here. So obviously I was on board with, signing on with them to try to do something just to give us some answers. Because when whatever the trouble is, people call the police. Even if it's a mental health crisis and then it's the argument of that shouldn't be handled by the police. If there's a problem, our society has been taught for years, if there's a problem, you call the police. There are times that it's not our expertise, but we have to do something about it at that time. And what can we do going forward? We've got to do something better.
Yeah, this is really a remarkable story of sort of vision and understanding of the whole larger context. You have a community in crisis because these kids are creating public safety. They're dangerous to the community, and that's your job. On the one hand, you're able to recognize that these are kids in utter crisis who, the root of the problem is something has gone horribly awry in these kids' lives. And the answer is not repeated, jail or incarceration or medical stays. They need something, a fundamental transformative change. And so I understand from what you're saying, you put a call out saying, help us. This is a community issue, right? This is not a police issue.
Right.
And it's not really a kid issue. It's a community issue. So, Mr. Munger, I want to turn to you next, because one of the unique features of this grant is that it's awarded to a collective and not to an established organization. And what Chief Carroll has just said is that there was no established organization saying, bring us in, we'll take care of this. We know exactly what to do. You actually had to create something that didn't exist, something completely new, and something based in, as I understand it, a real sense that this is a community problem, and we as a community are going to have to come together to address the needs that are not being met for these kids and figure out a better solution forward. So, Mr. Munger, can you tell us about the collective that formed to apply for?
The chief may well be understating the nature of the problem, because in the fall of 2022, we knew there were mental health challenges for middle school kids and high school kids. But this happens in a context of no housing, housing crisis, and the fentanyl crisis. And so the thing is complex. There are a lot of interacting factors. People wanted the schools to solve this problem. Schools can't by themselves. And so there was an awareness in the fall of 2022 and in the winter, spring of 2023, individuals can't do it together. So there's a big community meeting where people gather to say, what can we do? And not everybody was in agreement on what the nature of the problem was, and they certainly weren't in agreement on what to do about it. But the idea was to get together and to have a lot of different people at the table, not the usual suspects, if you will. So to bring in other voices to try to figure out what was going on and what might be some constructive first steps. And to the police department's great credit, they began to experiment and began to create small initiatives of reaching out to these troubled kids, playing ball with them, hosting them, making contact with them, showing them respect, being human to them. And that was really important. People got inspired by that. And so a group of other people then began to say, what can we do? We had a big meeting in March of 2023, 40 people. We had 100 people at the Samoset Hotel in June of 2023. And everybody's saying, we can't solve this problem by ourselves. We have to do something together. We will be stronger together. Hence, a collaborative was born. We call ourselves the Midcoast Community Collaborative.
Thanks. It's really an extraordinary story of community collectivity coming together. We hear a lot about how our country is fragmented. We're all alienated from each other. Community is dissolving. Community fronts are, our community bonds are fraying. Interpersonal relationships are, going in the way of computers. And you're pulling together 100 people at a resort to meet a collective challenge of the needs of your kids. What's so special about your approach? What is it that you think made your grant proposal stand out for this significant grant?
Well, again, I think a lot of credit goes to the police department. We started this, the collaborative, before the grant, but people working in the collaborative, people with a mental health background, people with a pediatric background, social worker background, educator background, all said, what can we do? And do we have the assets in place here for Rockland to apply? And we concluded that we did. And Jessica Berry put together a grant with elements from the University of Southern Maine Place Matters, with the Restorative Justice Institute of Maine, with the University of Maine and Orono as evaluators, to say, if we got a planning grant, what could we learn? What could other communities around the country? The grant we got, based on the strength of the police department, we're one of 26 communities in the country that was awarded this grant. So it was highly competitive. But our hope is that we can learn enough about what we're doing in the next 18 months to have some useful lessons for others who will want to do things themselves. And it will help us solidify gains we've made and create other gains.
This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, and today we're talking about Midcoast Maine Collective with Chief Tim Carroll from Rockland and Mark Munger, a local resident, about the collective that's formed to bring the community members together to try to address problems that youth are having in the community. Chief Carroll, I want to go back to a point that you made that, you know, what we often hear is kids who are creating trouble, you know, send them away, like get them off the streets, get them into some sort of a carceral setting where their behavior can be interrupted, the community can be made safer, the kids can get some help that they need. And what I hear you saying is that standard intervention for kids simply was not working in this case. We're living in a state where we have a call to close Long Creek, and there's, you know, the number of kids incarcerated in Long Creek is very, very, very small. But what you're saying is that this particular situation made very clear that we lack alternatives for children who are in deep, serious crisis. If we don't want to put them in prison, we don't have existing alternatives to give the intervention and the support that they need. And so if we understand a standard intervention to be incarceration for their safety and for everybody else's safety, but it's not working because they return to the street exhibiting the same behavior or perhaps even worse behaviors. So what is it that was not working for these kids? Of what was already existing, what was not working? And what, in your opinion, did these kids need that didn't exist yet in the community?
I honestly think they just needed a big part of what we did was, and Mark brought it up, is just showing some respect and to listen to these kids. And you know, some of the stories that we heard from these kids, once we were able to get past the point of the fighting and the language and everything else, once we were get to a point of conversations with these kids, not to justify their actions, but you get a better understanding of where they're coming from and their backgrounds of how they've been brought up and passed around. And I think our approach of showing that we care, we want to do something. And I think it's going to be that approach if we have to keep it locally for these kids to say that we do care, because I'm a former sheriff and I was in charge of a jail population. I worked harder at getting people out of jail because I want them to return back to their families, getting a job, taking care of the kids, and becoming successful, because I feel, you know, I want this community success to be successful. And that's the only way to do that is everybody. You're as strong as your weakest link, right? So we need to get the help that is necessary for these kids to see that they have value, that they have worth, and that they can be contributing members at any age to our community. And it's getting people involved, like, again, Mark and Jess. The landing place is a local place here that kids go to, and they do fantastic work. But it's just showing these kids a little respect and giving them some worth, instead of the approach of, well, you broke the law and this is what's going to happen and there's a penalty to pursue. No, we're not doing it that way. That's not what is needed for these kids. It's not going to work.
And if I can interrupt, there's no recipe for this, but there's some basic elements. We're trying to engage various perspectives. So the landing place, which deals with troubled youth, is provides extraordinary help on a 24/7 basis. Straight Ahead Ministries is involved in serving these children. They weren't at the table before. They're now important players at the table. We're trying to create new narratives. We're trying to help everybody tell new stories that there could be a way out of this stuff. And the 13-year-old can prosper and thrive rather than thrash about and fail. We're trying to recognize some hidden actors. There's a wonderful barber on Main Street who gives free haircuts to some of these troubled kids. And he's a therapist, if you will. And he's part of what we're doing. We're trying to figure out who goes back and forth between the various networks in our community. Who's the glue between different groups and how can they be more influential? And last and not least, we're trying to get some intergenerational wisdom. We're asking the kids what's going on. We're asking their grandparents what's going on.
So, you know, I'm hearing a few different things. I'm hearing offering the kids respect rather than just punitive intervention is critically important. I'm hearing listening to them is critically important. I'm hearing that building community ties that can show up for these kids and hold these kids is critically important. I'm wondering about more material resources. Mark, you had mentioned housing shortage. I'm wondering what the collective can do, what the material deficiencies are in these kids' lives and what the collective might be able to do to meet those material deficiencies. Like what would actually really make a material difference for these kids?
It's, you know, a lot of the times that we've the kids that we're dealing with, I've been a law enforcement officer here in the Knox County area for 20 years. I also dealt with these kids' parents. And you know, there's that aspect of it as well. So I've got to, you know, officers here have relationships with the parents of these kids, and we try to work with them as well. We have one kid that they were going to be kicked out of their apartment, and he didn't know what to do. He was scared. He acted out. He was scared, but he had no control over being kicked out of their apartment. But we took efforts in ways, talked to the mother, and we were able to get them to be able to stay in their apartment through the help of the community of keeping them there. And just that little bit really helped that young man really kind of turn the corner too. Just again, it was getting respect and showing it.
If we could wave the magic wand, we'd get housing for everybody, but we can't. And the collaborative is not a big organization. We don't exist as an organization. We're a convening backbone network. So we're trying to get people to the table who might do this. So there's a lot of outreach now to the business community in Rockland and in Knox and Lincoln counties. There are pockets of wealth, but pockets of extreme poverty in this area. And we're trying to figure out what policies and practices might work that we can't pull off ourselves, but we can help others think more creatively about doing it and find ways to do it. So Maine Health, Penn Bay are obvious players in this. We're thinking of early childhood. We'd like to go upstream to influence how the children develop and grow up by the time they get to be in middle school. There's a lot of stuff going on. Like everybody, we have aspirations and we're trying to experiment and we're going to learn by doing.
Well, I mean, it is a novel experiment for Maine in the 21st century. I think, you know, that obviously getting this grant is indicative of that. And your ability to vision beyond simply intervening in a punitive way, but to actually rebuild community networks and build new community networks is what's so novel about this. So, Mr. Munger, can you talk to us about, like, what will the collective actually be doing? Like, what's the day-to-day work? It's not an organization, it's a collective. I think our listeners will be very interested in trying to understand the difference there. And the collective, I understand a lot of it is bringing people in to support, networking, building ties, but can you describe that a little bit more fully?
We are conveners, and so we're curious, and we go and ask what's going on, what's working, and we say, have you talked with so-and-so? Who else should be involved in this? And so we have lots of meetings, too much coffee, too many donuts, and we're trying to figure out how...
I think that was a cop thing.
But... Yeah. we're trying to figure out as we go along. So we're deeply aware that we're an experiment. The Community Caring Collaborative in Washington County is the prototype in Maine for doing this work. And they inspire us and they've been of some technical assistance. But we're trying to figure it out, Catherine, as we go along. And there's no blueprint for it. There's one step forward and maybe a half step back, and then we stop and reconvene. This is a planning grant. I want to be clear about this. This is not giving resources to local agencies who desperately need it. If we were luckier, we'd have those resources to give, but we're not. But we hope the planning can create more resources by bringing attention and goodwill and a sense of hope that we can do this together. I wish I could be more specific to you about what we are, but none of us has a full-time, none of us is on payroll. Everybody has a full-time job. This is all kind of volunteer stuff on the backs of already hardworking people.
Yeah, no, I think that's clear, and I love your articulation of that, because what you're trying to do is not a job, right? It's life. What you're trying to do is build a healthy community, and the message that you're sending is we are figuring it out as we go along. We are not an organization that has a model that this grant is investing in. We are, you know, we are being invested in as visionaries who are trying to rebuild a fragmented community with some very damaged children. Chief Carroll, I'm interested, how for you, how do you measure success? What would success for this planning grant look like for you?
The planning grant, I'm hoping at the end of it, we may find some options which are resources for us, for these kids that are troubled. Because, you know, as much as we want to do, as much as we try to help with these kids and our interactions with these kids and having, you know, these nightly visits at the rec center and those types of things, at the end of the day, we still have to go to that accident call. We still have to go to that domestic. We still have to. So, but if we have that opportunity to deal with that youth or that group of youths, and have it opportunities to say, this is what you need to do, and be able to take them there, help them get there, and say, this is a resource. You're in this state. This is the best resource for you. How about we have this conversation? And to build those, you know, keep building those relationships, so they trust us to know that we're not going to lead them astray. We're not going to, you know, punitively charge them with anything, and they have to pay some sort of penance for their issues, but we're going to get them the help that they need, and they trust us to do that. That's what I would consider success for the police department, for members of the police department. We have the resources to get these kids to get the help that they need. It's not about the penance at the end of the day. It's about getting them the help that they need so they can become successful. Their success is our success.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Munger, how about for you? How will you measure success?
Not sure. Collaboration isn't easy. And how we're doing in real time to guide ourselves is a standing issue. The building relationships, organizing, convening, leaning on people, cajoling, inviting people is tough work. If we can find better ways to do that, if we can look hard in the mirror and say, what are we doing well? What do we need to do better? Maybe with the help of some other outside people, we can create, you ought to try this, maybe you ought to not try that kind of thing. I hope after 18 months, I'll have a better answer for you.
We'll come back to you then. That would be great. I have one more question. This is a really big one. And this is asking you to step away from the specificity of this group of children, and perhaps to even step away from the specificity of the particular material issues and resource shortages that you're facing. This is kind of a visionary question. And I want to ask you, in your perfect world, in your utopic world, what makes a healthy community? What are the things that you would look at and say, now that is a thriving community that is invested in everybody's well-being? What does a community need to be healthy, thriving, and characterized by well-being? So Chief Carroll, I'm going to come to you first.
Trust. Trust and support of each other within the community. And I think with this planning grant, as Mark said, reaching out to those people that maybe they're not aware of the resource that they can be, but maybe highlight some of that. But it's trust and supporting each other, so that we are, at the end of the day, as I stated earlier, at the end of the day, we're all successful and the community is successful because we're all successful. And we can, you know, we can recognize each other's faults, but also we can, you know, praise their accomplishments and work with each other through trust and support.
And I understand you to be saying that part of that trust is also an ability to be vulnerable and ask for help, and a willingness to give help and know it will be received. That's sort of the nature of trust, right? That almost a trust in the possibility of selfless mutual aid. If you need help, people will help you. And then if they in turn need help, you will help them. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
It is. I mean, there's some vulnerability for us because, you know, the respect of the, you know, the tough cop of having to enforce the laws and that things, we're stepping out of our box to say, you know, and there is there's thought in the community of these kids, you know, need punishment. There needs to be some sort of recourses for their actions. But the police are saying, no, that's not what we're looking at. We're trying to get these kids the help that they need. So we're taking a much different approach regarding what police work typically does or has done in the past to, again, try to just take care of kids. That's you know, that's our future, as they say, right? So,
and as citizens see what the police are doing, many of them regard it as bold and admirable and needed,
which is what we want. So, Mr. Munger, I'm going to come to you with the same question. What for you are the markers of a thriving, healthy community characterized by collective well-being?
I'm going to use a 50 cent concept of social cohesion, where people appreciate diverse points of view, as the chief was saying, different ways of living, but are more tolerant of and more understanding our frailties and our strengths, and gain satisfaction from helping one another. Part of the climate emergency folks trying to improve community resilience are focusing on this, but their problem is it's 20, 30 years out. We got it in front of us right now. So what is a community? Asking that question then creates answers to your question.
Chief Carroll, Mr. Munger, thank you so much for talking to us. I'm going to come back in 18 months. We're going to have this conversation again, find out how things went, where you're headed next, how things are looking for these kids. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, and Aaron Pyle, our sound engineer. I'm Catherine Besteman. We are Justice Radio.